Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Bio 231. And we're going to have a lecture on digestive system today. After I turn the volume down just a little bit. Oh, actually, if I leave it loud, I can just whisper. That would really save my voice. Maybe I won't turn it down just a little bit. All right, so today is May 9th. We're going to have a lecture on digestive system. And before we get started, let's look at the schedule, see where we are. Today is May 9th, so on the schedule, May 9th is Digestive System, Chapter 23. And there are no practicums or lecture exams this week, but next week we do have a lab practicum, and some of you might have one or two quizzes depending on what lab you're in. Monday labs get two quizzes, the Wednesday lab only gets one quiz. And no lecture exam, but you do have the lab practicum as well. And then the week after, on a Monday, the 21st of May, is your last exam. And sometimes if it's the last exam, we call it a final exam, but it's not a cumulative final. It's just an exam over these chapters right here. And then on the 23rd, there's no class. You don't have to come to class. And then graduation is on the 30th. That's after Memorial Day. Raise your hand if you're going to graduate this year. I don't see many hands. Okay, I'm not graduating either, so I know how you feel. Okay, I'll be back next semester. Now, on Monday, coming up on Monday, let's see, Monday you're going to have a lecture on urinary system. We're covering that fairly well in lab. Right, so you know what the nephron is and all that kind of stuff. I will not be here on Monday. You're going to have a guest lecturer. So give him as much problem as you can imagine. Okay? Actually, be really nice to him. Okay? It's going to be Dr. Lee. He's going to come in. Probably you don't know Dr. Lee, but you'll get to know him just a little bit. He'll give you a lecture on urinary system. And those of you that are taking a practicum that day, I won't be here for the practicum either. So you'll have a guest proctor person come in. It's going to be Dr. Lee in the afternoon and Professor Sato in the morning. But if you have questions, I don't really know. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, but sometimes the answer key doesn't help in answering the questions, right? Usually, so you're talking about the lab practicum in particular.
Yeah.
Sometimes when somebody has a question, oh yeah, he'll have the answer key to make sure that things are labeled properly, so if a label falls off. But a lot of times I get questions from students and my answer sometimes makes it more difficult for them to answer the question. Usually what I like to do is read the question, and that helps you zoom in. So just look right at the tip of the arrow and read the question. That's the most important thing. Okay, and we'll try to label it as precisely as possible. That's just the way it goes. All right, but that's okay, because I'll be back on Wednesday. At least as it stands right now, I'll be back on Wednesday for your talk on diversification system. Okay, and I'll be there available then for the practicums on those days. So that's the schedule. But because I'm not going to be here on Monday, doesn't mean that you shouldn't be here on Monday either. You should be here on Monday. All right, because I'm going to pass the sign-in sheet around, and anybody who's not here, I'll drop from the class. Okay? I can't do that, but at least I can threaten to do it. All right, so please come to class on Monday. All right, so today we're going to look at digestive systems. Does anybody have a question on the schedule? Remaining schedule? No, you're all good with that. Okay, so I'll put that away. And then here is just the text slides for digestive system. So the reason why we have a digestive system is to mostly bring in nutrients that our body requires and energy that our body requires to stay alive. And in some cases, it helps in recycling certain materials and excretion of materials from our body. Okay, but that's mostly done by the respiratory and urinary system. Digestive system mostly is for bringing in nutrients and other helpful products inside our body. So the slide on the right, let me turn some of these lights down. The slide on the right shows the whole digestive system, and the digestive system has components for digestion and absorption, and then accessory structures, just like vision had a number of structures directly involved with vision and then some accessory structures. All right, so the structures that are directly involved with digestion and absorption will be the oral cavity right here and the tongue. Some accessory structures in the oral cavity will be the salivary glands and teeth, the teeth for breaking up big particles of food into smaller particles of food, small enough to swallow. Salivary glands add lubrication to that bolus of food so that it can slide down this long tube, the esophagus, into the stomach. And the salivary glands also, some of them secrete an enzyme that can digest starch. Starch is a complex sugar, and those enzymes break a complex sugar, namely starch, down into simple sugars, which can be absorbed by your body. And then your body can take those simple sugars and make another large molecule out of them, a molecule similar to starch, but we call that glycogen. So an animal starch is glycogen, a plant starch is starch. Sorry, I don't know where I was going with that. Okay, so food then moves down through the esophagus into the stomach. The stomach is a big pouch that holds the food that we eat. It's processed just very minimally. Some initial kinds of protein digestion take place in the stomach at a very acid pH, and that material then moves into the small intestine that we see right here, and the pH changes radically from being very acidic to being very alkaline or very basic. And this is where the majority of digestion and absorption takes place, the small intestine. And remember, the small intestine has got three divisions. Proximal is duodenum. The very distal segment is the ileum, and the middle segment is the jejunum. And it's really hard to tell exactly where the jejunum is because it's in the middle. But the duodenum is easy to tell because it's connected to the, what's the duodenum connected to? The stomach. And the ileum is easy to tell because it's connected to the, it's connected to the large intestine, or even better yet, a part, the first part of the large intestine is called the cecum right here. So here is the cecum. And in some animals, it's a very large organ. In humans, it's pretty small because we're an omnivore. We don't eat primarily plants. And so it has regressed, and that regressed part is what we call the appendix. The appendix in humans is largely lymphatic tissue that fights infection. And what is ironic about that? Just like the tonsils. Even though it's there to fight infection, it can become chronically inflamed or infected. And in that case, we call that appendicitis. And it will burst, or it should be removed from the body before it does. Because then you have all that rotting bacterial matter just floating anywhere in the abdominal pelvic cavity. What do we call that abdominal pelvic cavity? Because I want to use that when we get to the diversification system. Right, you got the pelvic cavity down here that holds mostly reproductive organs, and we have the abdominal cavity that holds mostly digestive organs, but what, there's nothing that separates them, so they're really one cavity. What do we give, what name do we give it? We could say abdominal pelvic cavity, and you would be right, but there's one word that describes the abdominal pelvic cavity together, and it's called the peritoneal cavity, right? Peritoneal cavity. And the membrane surrounding the peritoneal cavity is called what? The peritoneum. And when somebody has a burst appendix, that's a peritonitis, right? Because it's the abdominal pelvic cavity together that becomes inflamed as a result. All right, so then you got the large intestine right here. That has a specific function. And rectum and anal canal, that's got another function. And then this is how that material leaves your body, through the anus. Some accessory structures that we see. Right here, the salivary glands. We have the liver, and the liver produces a compound that aids in the digestion of lipids, and that, and you all know what that is. That is bile. So the liver produces bile. It's stored in the gallbladder when you're in a fasted state, and then the gallbladder contracts when you're in a fed state and squishes bile right into the pancreas, which is another accessory structure, and joins the pancreatic duct. And then that then enters the duodenum. The job of the pancreas makes a number of digestive enzymes for digesting starch, and that would be called pancreatic amylase. There are enzymes that break down proteins. That would be called a protease. So anytime you hear a word with an ASE on the end of it, then you're pretty much assured that that's going to be an enzyme, and the substrate for that enzyme will be the first part of the word. like a protein that's broken down by an enzyme is called a protease. ASE is the enzyme, protease stands for protein. And an enzyme that breaks down a lipid would be called a lipase. Right, ASE on the end and lipo on the front. Or just LIP, lipase. So that's a modern nomenclature for naming enzymes. All right, so let's take a look at some of these organs in detail. And first, we're going to look at the layers of the digestive tract. All these organs of the alimentary canal, not the digestive tract because the liver is part of it, but the alimentary canal, which is the tube running through your body, okay, has layers to it. And we're really concerned with all these layers because if there's a pathology that involves your digestive tract, then it's going to involve some of these different layers, and we want to know what layers are involved so that we can stage the disease. Here's what I want to look at. We can stage the disease, and then if we know the stage of the disease process, diagnose the disease and stage it, we can come up with a good treatment or therapy. Okay? Treatment and therapy can't be derived unless we know the stage and what the disease is. And also, if we can stage and know what the disease is, then we know what the prognosis is as well. So a lot of information is dependent on knowing these layers. So here we see a cross-section of the digestive system. This would be a good example of small intestine in particular. Yeah, question? This one right here. You know, I do have a model of this. So let's look at this. And I'll have maybe two questions of this on the practicum. Okay, and I think I'm going to produce a video this afternoon of the model of this that we have in lab. Okay, so there are four main layers that make up the alimentary canal that I see right here. The outermost layer is number four on the sheet. That's the serosa. So I see the serosa right here, which is a connective tissue layer. That's a pretty thin layer. And so it just is, it just holds the rest of the layers together, and it secretes a fluid and mucus so that it's kind of slippery because these intestines are moving around inside your body all the time. So here's the serosa. The next deepest layer we see contains a lot of muscle. So we can see these two red layers right here. And the stomach that you had to learn for a lab quiz, there are three layers, but in most parts of the alimentary canal, there are just two layers of smooth muscle. The superficial layer is a longitudinal layer, so when these muscles contract, the alimentary canal gets shorter in length. It pulls the length of the tube together. The next deepest layer are the circular smooth muscles. When these contract, it acts like a sphincter, right, and it closes off the tube. So you got longitudinal and circular layer of the muscularis externa. Right here, muscularis externa. But I also see that there are plenty of blood vessels in this layer, as well as these yellow fibers. These are nerve fibers. And we call these the intrinsic nerve plexus of the large intestine, or myenteric nerve plexus. These then coordinate how the small intestine and even all parts of the intestine contract together to move through food through the digestive system. Right, so the myenteric nerve plexus. And your digestive system is just loaded with nerve fibers. Now consider your spinal cord. If you were to think of your spinal cord, would you think that the spinal cord has a little or a large number of neurons? Few neurons or a lot? A lot. As a matter of fact, I would think it's one of the, besides the brain, a part of your body that contains most neurons is in your spinal cord. But you know what? There are more neurons in your digestive system or the alimentary canal than there are in your spinal cord. And as a matter of fact, for years and years and years before modern science was, people thought that the digestive system or the nerves of the digestive system was really your brain because there were so many nerves in your digestive system. All right, we call that the myenteric nerve plexus that controls contraction of all these smooth muscle cells, and of course that's under autonomic control. You don't have to think about that. It's all taken care of automatically for you if it's working correctly. All right, so myenteric nerve plexus, the longitudinal and circular layer make up the muscularis externa. And then the submucosa is this layer right here. The submucosa contains glands, and loose connective tissue, a lot of arteries, right? And also another layer of, oh, you know what? That's in the next deepest layer, right? So the submucosa is right here, mostly glands for secreting into the lumen of the digestive tract. All right, then the next deepest layer, the third one of the four, is the submucosa. So here I see, or the muscularis, no, submucosa, I'm right, submucosa, and then, so here's submucosa, and then deep to that is the mucosa. So we got serosa, the muscularis externa, the submucosa, and then deep to the submucosa is the mucosa, starting with another layer of smooth muscle. And you can see it arranged in a longitudinal fashion. And then some loose connective tissue that contains more glands, and this is what we call the lamina propria. So I would like for you to say lamina propria is part of the mucosa. And then the deepest layer is going to be the epithelium. And this epithelium is just a simple columnar epithelium with a bunch of goblet cells that secrete mucus and other glands that secrete digestive enzymes and other things into the lumen of the digestive tract. Okay, and the mucosa also contains lymphatic tissue that we call MALT, the mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue. So you can have many bacteria growing in your intestines, but they don't get into your body because they can't get past the mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue that's in the mucosa lining. So let's go from the outside again. You got serosa, muscularis externa, okay, the submucosa, and then the mucosa, which contains this muscle layer, lamina propria, and epithelium. And the lumen then is not really a layer, that's just the center part of this tube right here. And the muscularis has the myenteric nerve plexus, as well as the submucosa has more of a myenteric plexus in it as well. Most of these are parasympathetic neurons. And remember, the parasympathetic nervous system can be characterized as the rest and digest nervous system. So parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory on the digestive system. And what about the sympathetic nervous system? What can that be characterized by? Fight or flight, right? And that has nothing to do with digestion. So when you're scared, your digestive system is actually inhibited. So that blood flow goes to your brain, heart, and skeletal muscle so you can deal with that threat that you perceive. All right, so we see that there are a lot of nerves that control all these muscles of the digestive tract. So let's look at motility of the digestive tract just a little bit. There are two forms of motility. One form is called peristalsis, and the other form is called segmentation. Peristalsis, okay, is moving of food from mouth to anus in a single direction, moving food through your digestive system. Segmentation, on the other hand, is a way for mixing food. So it's the way sometimes where food or processed food is moved in a retrograde or in a backwards direction so that it gets mixed with food that is proximal to it. All right, so peristalsis moves. Maybe I'm going to have to zoom here. Hold on. View. Here we go. Like, got it. How about page width? That's a little bit better. So we'll see everything. Is that better or worse? A little bit better. Okay, a little bit smaller. But it's big on your screens. Okay. Okay, so peristalsis, it propels materials from one part of the digestive tract to another, just due to a coordinated contraction between circular and longitudinal smooth muscles. Segmentation is mixing. So it mixes, it churns, and it fragments digesting material, right? And it's due mostly to circular smooth muscle contraction and not to longitudinal. So here is an example of, okay, contraction of longitudinal and circular smooth muscles that is going to propel this bolus of food along the digestive tract. So this is peristalsis. So first this bolus of food is proximal, then it's kind of like in a middle section, and now here it is in a distal section. And so your digestive system has contraction of smooth muscle, but the longitudinal muscles also contract so that your intestines act like it's actually crawling over this bolus of food, moving in just one direction. Okay, segmentation, on the other hand, is a mixing, and longitudinal muscles aren't used, but circular muscles are used for contraction in this coordinated fashion. So here I see three different chambers in the digestive tract, and the contents of three of these chambers have a different color associated with them. So there are three separate boluses of food, and in the next contraction, this muscle here relaxes, and then this muscle contracts and this muscle contracts, thereby this portion and this portion of these two separate boluses then get combined together in this chamber right here. So it's going to mix these two chambers together. All right, and then the contraction is going to go back to where it was before, and then it's going to mix this chamber with this chamber right here, and eventually this whole segment of tube will have a nice homogeneous mixture of material instead of separate chambers containing different kinds of food as well as digestive enzymes. So the digestive enzymes get mixed together as well. All right, so this is an example of segmentation. All right, the stomach. Let's move on to the stomach. We talked about the esophagus and lab. It's a closed tube, so it has some important clinical implications because it's a closed tube. What was that important clinical ramification that we talked about with the esophagus, because it's a normally closed tube? Yeah, once it's damaged, what happens to it? It heals in a closed position. Yeah, just in a closed position. So people won't be able to swallow after that. All right, so here is the stomach. Its function is, and these are nice key terms that you should just memorize, storing and mixing. Okay, what kind of form of motility is mixing? We just talked about it. Mixing is segmentation. That's right. So the job of the stomach is to store food that we eat, because we can eat so much food it can't be processed by the small intestine, so it's got to hang out in the stomach until the small intestine is ready to accept it and process it, digest it, and absorb nutrients. All right? Plus, it mixes the food that we eat with gastric juice, right? And then that becomes chyme. So chyme is just a mixture of food and gastric juice. In gastric juice, there is a protease, and that's where the initial digestion of proteins into its building blocks occurs in the stomach. Right, those building blocks are not absorbed by the stomach, but they'll be absorbed in the small intestine. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid, that's right. So there's an enzyme called pepsin that can break complex proteins down into smaller fragments, which will eventually be completely digested down into amino acids that you can absorb in your body. All right, so that's the function. Very little digestion takes place, just some initial digestion with pepsin, and hydrochloric acid is necessary because pepsin can only work at a very acidic environment, like a pH of 1 or 2. What's the most, in terms of a number, what's the most acidic environment that can occur in reality? Okay, we said that the pH of the stomach is a pH of 1. How acidic can something be? It can be 0, okay? That's the most acidic. So the stomach contains about the most acidic environment that's possible. So it's highly, highly acidic, okay? And that pH number can range from 0 to 14, 0 being the most acidic, okay? Neutral is 7, and that pH of 1 is really far away from a neutral pH, right? And that comes from hydrochloric acid that's secreted into the lumen of the stomach. The stomach also secretes intrinsic factor, and that is a substance that's necessary for absorption of vitamin B12 from your diet. And you have to have this in your diet, that vitamin B12 is necessary for mitosis. It's necessary for proliferation of tissues. And there's one tissue in my mind that stands out as being highly prolific, because the cells that are produced only live for about 120 days and then they die. And then you have to replace those cells. And then you need mitosis to replace those cells. And we've talked about that tissue before. Does anybody remember what kind of tissue that is? And that is blood. In particular, red blood cells only live for about 120 days. They have to be replaced. Vitamin B12 is necessary to make new red blood cells. So without intrinsic factor, you don't get vitamin B12, and you can't, and without vitamin B12, you can't make red blood cells. And can anybody remember how many red blood cells die in your body every second? A good ballpark figure would be 1 million. So that means in order to prevent someone from becoming anemic, how many red blood cells does your body have to make every second? 1 million red blood cells. And what's the vitamin that's necessary to make those 1 million red blood cells every second? Vitamin B12. That's right. Okay. All right, so that's the stomach. Not so much for digestion and absorption, but for storing and mixing of things. Okay, there are, let's see if I can find, I'm a little bit far away from the screen to see. Ah, this looks good. All right, so here is the stomach. If we just look at a small cross-section of the stomach, here's the inside lining of the stomach, and you can see some columnar, simple columnar epithelium, but there are deep invaginations of the epithelium into the mucosa. We call these, at the surface, we call that a gastric pit, right? So it's just a big hole or pore. And then these are the gastric glands down over here. And remember, here's the muscularis externa in the stomach. It's got three layers instead of just longitudinal and circular, but there's also an oblique because the stomach is primarily responsible for segmentation, so there's an additional layer of smooth muscle right here. Okay, let's zoom into this gastric pit, and we can see the simple columnar epithelium and then some cells that don't have such a high signal on them. Those would be the goblet cells that secrete mucus onto the surface of the stomach right here. And mucus is a really tough compound. Not only does it act as a lubricant, but it acts as a nice barrier that prevents the acidic environment of chyme and gastric juice from actually dissolving the stomach away. So those goblet cells are very important for just protecting the lining of your stomach. But as you can imagine, right, that stomach is, these cells right here are in a very caustic environment. They don't live for a very long period of time either. And there are stem cells down in the this part of the gastric pit that replace these cells very often because, again, they don't live very long. And those cells need vitamin B12, right, to reproduce the cells that are dying that line the stomach. So this is a highly proliferative region in your body as well. So the goblet cells secrete mucus that usually protect the lining of the stomach. There are parietal cells down in the gastric gland over here that secrete hydrochloric acid into the lumen of the stomach and intrinsic factor for vitamin B12. There are chief cells way down over here that secrete a precursor to pepsin. Pepsin is the enzyme that can digest proteins, and the substance that it secretes is called pepsinogen. That's an important word. I want to point it out to you. Where's it? Oh, I got to click, and then I can rotate that up. Okay, so the chief cells down over here secrete something called pepsinogen. And if you ever see a word with an ogen at the end of it, like pepsinogen, you should remember this for physiology as well. As a matter of fact, you should remember all this for physiology class. But pepsinogen in particular, whenever you see ogen at the end of the word, it means it's an inactive form of the molecule, but can be converted into the active form very easily. So it's a good thing that these cells are secreting pepsin in an inactive form, because if it was secreting pepsin in an active form, what would happen to these cells right here? They would be digested as well by their own product, right? So they secrete an enzyme that's inactive. That enzyme is called pepsinogen. It gets secreted into the stomach, and there in the presence of hydrochloric acid, it gets converted into pepsin. So pepsinogen gets converted to pepsin in the lumen of the stomach, thereby protecting the integrity of these gastric pits and gastric glands right here. Okay. Ooh, one thing I forgot to mention, which is pretty cool. Let me see if I have it back up over here. Saliva. How much saliva is being produced? Does it say in my notes any? Saliva. We produce 500 mLs a day of saliva into our gas and secreted into our gastrointestinal tract. 500 mLs. That's half a liter. That's a pretty large volume of saliva. If that was lost from our body, that would promote dehydration. So let's just consider that. All right, the stomach secretes gastric juice, and the stomach secretes about 1.5 liters of gastric juice into the intestinal tract. That comes from your body every day. Again, that would promote dehydration of your body. All right, so I just want to keep tabs of this. So how many liters does our body lose by secreting it into our digestive tract from our oral cavity and our stomach? It's 2 liters of fluid every day. That is the volume of a big plastic Coke bottle that you have in your refrigerator, right? The big bottle. That's 2 liters. Okay. Okay, the small intestine. Let's move down to the small intestine. Okay, its function is digestion and absorption. So it is not like the stomach. Stomach is what? Storing and mixing. But the stomach is digestion and absorption. So this is where most of the digestive enzymes work. Those digestive enzymes come from the pancreas. There are proteases and lipases and amylases that come from the pancreas to digest proteins and lipids and starches. And the small intestine secretes by far the most fluid into the digestive tract. So almost another 2 liters. So that's 4 liters total so far that of fluid that our body loses just to our digestive tract. We would dehydrate very rapidly if we were to lose that from our body. And as a matter of fact, in some cases, people lose that volume from their body and even more when their digestive system becomes infected, right? And more people die of water loss than any other cause in the world. Okay, what do we call that when we lose copious amounts of fluid from our digestive tract? Yeah, that produces dehydration, but that process, okay, of losing all that fluid is called producing copious amounts of watery fecal material is called diarrhea. Okay, so most people in the world die of diarrhea when they eat contaminated food or contaminated water. And what's the most sensitive population of that particular malady? Okay, it's going to be the same for just about any other cause, and that is what? The newborns, young babies, and then the elderly population as well. But it's mostly newborns that die of dysentery or diarrhea because of improper drinking conditions. Okay. So, you got the divisions. Proximal division, the duodenum, middle is jejunum. The distal segment is the ileum that connects up to the large intestine. And in order for you to absorb, right, so absorption is an important function of the small intestine. In order for you to absorb nutrients, you need a large what? You need a large surface area, or a nice common way of thinking of this, everyday language, would be a nice doorway, right? So surface area and doorway are the same. So when we speak of surface area scientifically, you should be thinking of a doorway. Okay, and the surface area is just a measurement of the width of something times the length of a flat surface. All right, and there are important specializations in the small intestine that increase the surface area of the small intestine for absorption. And these modifications are listed right here. The first one is a plique circularis, or a circular fold, or a circular pleat. What's a pleat? It's just a folding that you could put in your clothes, right? Like a ruffle or something. And then there's a villus, and then there's microvilli. These are all specializations that increase the surface area for absorption. So the surface area of the small intestine would be about 3.5 square feet if it was just a simple, flat, straight tube. All right, so that's not very much. Let's take a look at the small intestine at some of these features right here. So where are some of these features? We see them. I don't see them. But you guys see them because you're closer. Here it is. So here's the small intestine. All right, so here we see just a convolution in the small intestine. All right, but if we look at the mucosa, we can see these folds. These are macroscopic folds in the small intestine. All right, and that increases the length of the tube because we can take the small intestine and stretch it out to flatten out all of these, what we call circular folds or plicae circularis, right, which would make the tube a lot longer, which means then that the surface area would be a lot greater for absorption. So that's the first specialization. The second specialization is on each of these circular folds, there are additional folds, and these are what we call villi. These are almost microscopic. You can't really pick them out with your naked eye, but if you were to look at the inside of the small intestine, it wouldn't look smooth and flat. It would look very velvety. So you can almost see these structures with your naked eye. So again, the length of the small intestine could be enlarged greatly if we were to pull it from end to end and flatten out all of these villi, that increases the surface area once again. Okay, and then if we look at just a cross-section of a villus, hopefully it's the next slide. Oh yeah, so here is a villus right here. Okay, and here is the columnar epithelium, and I see some goblet cells in there. And then these columnar cells also have microvilli on top of them poking into the lumen of the small intestine. All right, and we can make the small intestine even longer if we were to take the cell from end to end and then stretch it out to flatten out all the microvilli, then the small intestine would become even larger, making it a larger doorway for absorption. So the things that increase surface area for absorption would be the microvilli at a really microscopic level. These are even hard to see with a microscope because they're so small. And then if we put all these epithelial cells together, it forms a villus. That's a second feature. And don't forget, all these villi exist on what? A circular fold, which increases the length of the tube. And all of these folds right here are really nice because otherwise your small intestine would have to be like 100 times longer and it wouldn't even fit inside your body. Okay, so what's the best way really to think of that increase in surface area? Just thinking of all those structures right there. Is what? A doorway. So if we were to flatten out all of these folds, flatten out all the microvilli, flatten out all the villi, and flatten out all the circular folds, the surface area would increase to, well, from 3.5 square feet to 2,200 square feet. Or if we were to make it just a flat tabletop, it would be 47 feet by 47 feet. That's a huge surface area. That's about the surface area of a typical two-story house. So that's the importance for absorption, and that's what happens in the small intestine. Okay. Now there's a blood vessel that's specialized for exchange, for absorbing material. What kind of blood vessel is that? Because of the layers that it has. It has a thin layer, just a simple thin layer, and that's a capillary. So here are the capillaries within the villus for absorbing the breakdown products of proteins and the breakdown products of carbohydrates. Those would be sugars and amino acids. But the breakdown products of lipids, okay, don't get absorbed by a capillary because they would plug up the blood system, because remember, fat doesn't like to dissolve in water. But they're picked up by another kind of capillary, not a circulatory system capillary or a blood capillary, but a lymphatic capillary. And I can see that right in the very center of a villus. And that lymphatic capillary is called what? That's a lacteal. Okay, we mentioned that when we talked about the lymphatic system. All right, so lacteals absorb lipids or digested lipids into your body. And, okay, it gets packaged in chylomicrons. Those chylomicrons then allow lipid materials to form a little packet, but it's dissolvable in the fluid environment of a lymphatic blood vessel. All right, there are intestinal glands located between villi, like I see down over here in the submucosa. Some of those glands are Brunner's glands in the duodenum, the first part of the duodenum. They secrete an alkaline solution that's highly viscous. It's made out of mucus. And that alkaline solution does what? As chyme from the stomach, it's squirted into the small intestine. Yeah, it balances out the pH. First, it makes it neutral. right? And then it makes it alkaline so that the other digestive enzymes from the pancreas can work on proteins and then break them down into amino acids. Right, there are crypts of Leverkusen, also known as an intestinal glands that I see over here. Right, and they contain goblet cells that secrete mucus, enteroendocrine cells that secrete hormones into the digestive tract that regulate peristalsis between the stomach and the small intestine, and also secretion of digestive enzymes, so there's no reason to be secreting a lot of lipase into the small intestine unless there are lipids. So lipids, high lipid content in the lumen of the small intestine will then stimulate contraction of the gallbladder through a hormone that's released by the small intestine. And that's called cholecystokinin, signals the gallbladder to release bile from the pancreas. All right, and the epithelium also has stem cells in this region right here, enteroendocrine cells. They replace the lining of the small intestine at least every week, sometimes maybe twice a week. So this is another highly proliferative region in your body. And it requires a vitamin. What requirement is necessary to replace the lining of your digestive tract every couple of days? Vitamin B12, that's right. So anytime somebody is taking a chemotherapeutic agent to battle cancer, one of the problems with cancer is that the cells grow so fast, so a lot of the chemotherapy is designed at targeting cells that are undergoing mitosis very rapidly or proliferating. That's why somebody that's on those kinds of anti-cancer drugs have problems with their digestive tract, including severe nausea, because those drugs also prevent the proliferation of this epithelium right here of the digestive tract. And that's just one of the side effects, unfortunate side effects of chemotherapy. I'm not so familiar with diverticulitis other than a course of antibiotics, okay, and not eating, abstinence of food. So diverticulitis is an infection of the large intestine, and I think the best way of dealing with that is with antibiotics and not putting material into the large intestine. In the large intestine, yeah, there are things called ticks, which are large pockets in the large intestine. But remember, this epithelium here, we're looking at just a microscopic level, and I don't think the large intestine proliferation of these columnar cells can ever get rid of a tick or a pocket in the large intestine. Once you get them, I think you pretty much have them. The best thing to do is to eat the kinds of material that can't get trapped in those little pockets anymore, like little seeds. Okay, and so diet is the best way to deal with ticks. But it would be nice to figure out a way to get them to regress. Maybe somebody knows, but I don't know a way of doing it. Okay, so once somebody has diverticulosis or diverticulitis, they're more prone to get it again and again and again if their diet is inappropriate. Okay. Which I mean is their diet would be inappropriate, but would be entirely appropriate for everybody else. It's not like they're doing something weird to themselves. Okay. And then there are other cells called PANA cells that secrete bactericide into the lumen that helps make just beneficial bacteria develop in the lumen of the digestive tract, and we need to have special kinds of bacteria in our digestive tract because those bacteria help make things, vitamins, like vitamin B12, right? So we can't get rid of all bacteria, but we don't want pathologic or disease-causing bacteria in our digestive tract, and it's the Paneth cells right here that control what kind of bacteria can grow in our intestinal tract, and we have a symbiotic relationship with them because they provide benefit to our body. All right, there's also nodes, like I see right here and right here. This is more MALT, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. All right, sometimes we call these Peyer's patches in the small intestine. All right, I think I'm going to come back to the pancreas because I want to go on to the large intestine. And we still have some time to talk about the large intestine right here. So let's look at large intestine. All right, so the junction between the The large intestine and small intestine is right here. And what's that distal segment of the small intestine called once again? The last segment, distal segment of the small intestine is the ileum, right? So here's the ileum right here. It empties into this proximal division of the large intestine. This is what we call the cecum, right? We just talked about that. And then here's the little vestigial part of the remnant of the cecum that's only lymphatic tissue in us, and that's the vermiform appendix. The cecum is part of the ascending colon, and there is a valve right here, just like there's a pyloric sphincter between the stomach and the small intestine. Here is a valve that controls the motion of digesting material from the small intestine into the large, and that's called the ileocecal valve. And it's a circular smooth muscle, and sometimes we call a circular smooth muscle a sphincter, just like the pyloric valve, sometimes called the pyloric sphincter. And that can be seen pretty nicely on our dissections. All right, so then we have the ascending colon, and it makes a 90-degree bend. We call that a flexure. And since it's by the liver, because the liver is on the right side of the body, we call that hepatic flexure, or you could call it the right colic flexure. Then here is the transverse section, and then another flexure. And since the spleen is right there, we call that the splenic flexure, then descending colon, and then it moves a little posteriorly, forms a little squiggle right here. That's the sigmoid colon. And the large colon does have a job, an important job, and it's not for digestion. It's primarily for absorption, but not absorption of nutrients. It's for the absorption of water and salt. So remember, all that material, all that water that we place into our digestive tract, saliva, gastric juice, intestinal juice, was what? Over 4 liters of fluid. If we were to lose that from our body, we would dehydrate very rapidly, probably within a couple hours. Okay? So it's the job, very important job of the large intestine is to resorb all that water and put it back into our cardiovascular system. That's its job. All right, so no digestion, but absorption of salt and water, but also some vitamin K. And vitamin K is necessary in order for you to have good and proper blood clotting function. So without vitamin K, you could bleed to death pretty easily. And vitamin K is produced by bacteria, or precursors of vitamin K are produced by bacteria that live in the large intestine. So again, that kind of emphasizes the necessary for a symbiotic relationship between bacteria that are in your digestive tract and your normal physiology would be altered. Okay, now when the large intestine gets irritated, it's usually because the bacteria get stimulated. And guess what bacteria need to live and thrive? The same thing that you do. You need nutrients, right? And what did we say? What was the job of the small intestine? Let's go back. Oops. Job of the small intestine was digestion and absorption. All right, so the small intestine absorbs nutrients from your diet and puts them in your body. But if for whatever reason the small intestine doesn't absorb those nutrients, where do they go? Where do nutrients go if the small intestine doesn't absorb them? Into the large intestine, okay? And guess who is waiting there? Billions of bacteria. If you stimulate those bacteria with nutrients, they're going to proliferate like crazy. They're all going to have smiles on their faces, right, running around, and it's going to cause an irritation of the large intestine, okay? And then the large intestine can't do its job, can't absorb all that water, and that water is just going to exit your body. And we call that diarrhea, right? So there are some drugs that people have used in the past, and I think you still can buy, maybe even over the counter, that block the absorption of fat from the small intestine. Okay, and it was called Xenical, and now it's called Ally. And somebody that wants to help control their body weight, one of the ways to do that is to prevent absorption of lipids from your diet, because lipids are highly caloric, right? So if you block absorption of lipids, right, that's a way that you could lose a lot of weight potentially. But if you're not absorbing those lipids, where do they go? They go into the large intestine, and those bacteria say, thank you very much. And as a result of those drugs, that produces copious amounts of watery diarrhea, but also oily, watery diarrhea. And all these smooth muscles are highly irritated, so they contract uncontrollably. So sometimes people on those medications have no idea when they're stooling themselves. So what do you have to wear when you're on Xenical or Ally? It's a good thing to wear. Diapers, right? So you could be given a lecture. You could be driving down the 405 freeway. What do we call that when you have an unintended consequence of a pharmaceutical agent that you're taking? That's what we call a side effect. Yeah, so one of the side effects of these drugs that block absorption is what we call malabsorption syndrome, right? So malabsorption syndrome is a side effect. And a lot of drugs have that side effect. You can read the side effect on your medication bottles, and if the side effect is diarrhea, mostly you can then diagnose that as being what? A malabsorption syndrome. That drug is preventing the absorption of some kind of nutrient from a part of your digestive system, which is what part of your digestive system? It's going to be small intestine, because that's the part that's there for absorption almost all of the time. Okay, so that's malabsorption syndrome. That's why when you guys start practicing in a hospital, you're going to have to keep going to school and getting your continuing medical education units. You should always go and listen to a lecture by a gastroenterologist. That is somebody that specializes in intestines and intestinal disorders, stomach disorders or intestinal disorders, because I guarantee you, you'll never fall asleep during one of those lectures. And those guys usually, or women, usually have a marvelous sense of humor as well, because they're dealing with this stuff day in and day out. And if you're normal, like most of us are in here, okay, in terms of the digestive system, it's one system we really take for granted, but if it ever starts to misbehave, as you can imagine, it can really turn your life upside down, and it does for many, many thousands of people. Okay, so go listen to those specialists. They'll really open your eyes on how to treat disease and what some of the disease processes could be. Okay, so know all the parts of the large intestine, but remember, it's not for absorption. Where does absorption take place? Small intestine. And if nutrients enter the large intestine, that is what? Highly problematic for an individual, because you have bacteria then that can use that as a nice energy source. So those bacteria should be controlled. Okay, liver neutralizes acids, right? Because the liver produces bile, and bile neutralizes acid from the stomach, because bile is secreted into the duodenum via the pancreatic duct. I think you have to draw that out in lab. Another function of bile is that it breaks big globs of fat down into smaller globs so that they can be absorbed and digested down into building blocks of lipids. So that's an important function of bile. So bile kind of acts like a little detergent that gets added to your digestive tract, right? Because that's why you put detergent in your washing machine, to break down lipids. So make sure you know the bile duct anatomy. I don't want to go over that. We looked at that to a large degree in lab already. Actually, you're experts on that. The liver can also store various compounds. It can store lipid-soluble vitamins like vitamin A and B12, D, and vitamin K. K right here sometimes refers to potassium, which is a metal ion, an element that's necessary in your body. But also vitamin K is a different organic molecule compared to potassium. But your liver can store elemental metals like copper and iron, because you need these in your body for enzymatic processes. And iron is necessary for what important function in your body? It's got a couple, but primarily it is for transporting oxygen in your blood, because red blood cells need a lot of iron, because iron is incorporated with heme to make hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a molecule that transports oxygen everywhere in our body. So if you don't have iron, you have a form of anemia, because your blood, you might have the right number of red blood cells, but if they can't carry oxygen, that produces an anemia as well. The liver can also interconvert numerous compounds. It can convert fat into phospholipids. Did you ever run into a phospholipid before? What's it good for? Making cell membranes. Every cell membrane in your body is made from phospholipids, so the liver does that. It can convert a precursor form of vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. What can vitamin D help prevent in everybody? There's a disease process that all of us will have to go through, especially women, though, as we get older. Osteoporosis. That's right. So vitamin D is necessary to absorb calcium from our diet, just like intrinsic factors necessary to absorb vitamin B12. The liver helps make an active form of vitamin D. Liver can also convert amino acids, which is the building block of a protein, into sugar. And it can convert protein and sugar into fat. All right, it can't convert sugar into... Oh, I don't want to say anything about that. All right, it takes a very toxic compound, which is a degradation process of proteins. It can take ammonia, which is super, super toxic, and convert it into urea, which is easily excreted by the kidneys. And when somebody has liver damage, guess what builds up in your body? Ammonia, right? And that produces an encephalopathy. It means we lose brain function when that happens. And of course, we can't live without our brain at all. So the liver is very important for getting rid of that very toxic compound. And the liver also produces clotting factors, blood clotting factors. So without proper liver function, then you could bleed to death very easily as well. All right, so let me go back up to talk about... I want to go back to the slide right over here. In lab, we talk about cancer of the reproductive tract, right, and one form of cancer. There's another prevalent or very easily contracted form of cancer, and that's colon cancer, okay, which happens in the sigmoid colon, ascending colon. I forget how many people in the United States die of colon cancer, way more than other kinds of cancers. I don't know, 20,000 people, something like that. I don't know. Who's got a cell phone? I give you permission to use your cell phone and Google colon cancer to find out how many people have it. But anyway, lots of people. And that's really kind of a sad disease to die from because it's easily detected. And if it's detected early, it's 100% curable because the large intestine, if you have a cancer right here, it can be resected here and here. These segments can be joined together. And then the cancer then is just removed from your body before it metastasizes to other organs, right? So easy ways to tell if you have colon cancer is by looking for occult blood in feces. Blood is kind of red when it comes out over here. It might look kind of black or red, but a very little amount you won't notice because feces are really dark. Oh, you know what? What the heck is the function of the large intestine again? What is it? What is it to do? Reabsorb all that water that got placed in our digestive tract. And when that water is resorbed, the remnant material is what we call, what, feces. So another way of saying what the function of the large intestine is the formation of feces, fecal formation. But what is fecal formation? It's just the removal of water from this material back to your body, right? So fecal formation and absorption of water are really the same kind of thing. All right, and feces is kind of dark, so you can't really see blood in feces right here, but with a chemical assay, it's really easy to do. Looking for occult blood in feces is a really nice way to find colon cancer early, but there's even a better way before you end up with blood in feces. Okay, and what does occult blood mean? When we say occult, what does that mean? Occult just means hidden, means secret, right? And because you can't see that dark pigment in feces, because feces is dark already, that's why they call it an occult blood sample, right, from fecal material right here. But it's better to catch colon cancer before then, and the best way of doing that is orthoscopically, where somebody inserts a video camera with a light, okay, and maybe some surgical instruments, up in through the anus and anal canal and rectum and move around through the sigmoid colon. That's what we call a sigmoidoscopy, right? And that's a relatively short tube, maybe about 18 inches long, and it can find colon cancer in this part of the colon. All right, but you could get tumors up in this part, the ascending, in which case you don't want a sigmoidoscopy, right? You want an investigation of the whole ascending colon right here. And that's not a particularly uncomfortable exam if it's done right. But you know what the terrible part of that exam is? Well, they can't look around if the large intestine is filled with feces. So you have to remove all of the feces. And Depending on your physician, they have a preferred method, but most of them will have you drink a gallon of this electrolyte mixture that's called Go Lightly. Okay? And it's not lightly like L-I-G-H-T, it's L-Y-T-E, standing for electrolyte, because you can't drink a whole gallon of water without disturbing your electrolyte balance inside your body, so it's called Go Lightly. But that's the last thing in the world that will happen to you. You won't go lightly, you will go very heavily. Okay? And the first couple sips of this gallon is okay, but after about five sips it's pretty disgusting, and then after about a quart it's really disgusting, and then after about a gallon it gets terribly disgusting to drink, and then the last half gallon is really hard. So sometimes, all right, a patient doesn't want to drink the whole gallon, they'll just drink half a gallon. And they'll go in and get prepped and get anesthesia, right? And then that scope will be placed up into their large intestine, and the physician is going to say, well, I can't see anything. You got to go home, come back next week or tomorrow. But before you do, you have to drink that whole gallon. So now what do you have to drink? Not just a whole gallon, but a gallon and a half of that stuff, right? So when a physician says, drink a gallon of this stuff, be sure you do it. Don't just drink half a gallon or a quart, because you're going to have to repeat the process, right? So the difficult thing about the exam is preparation. So be sure to follow your instructions from your physician exactly, so that you don't have to go back and repeat the procedure, because you don't want to miss that cancer that's growing in here, because that will be fatal if that happens, right? So the consequences are dire. All right, so colon cancer is easily treatable if it's caught early, and if there's any family history of colon cancer in your family, then you just have to get this exam early in your life and repeat it fairly frequently. And they'll look for growths that we call polyps, and polyps are precancerous growths that then can be removed without a resection of your large intestine. And that, again, prevents you from getting colon. And colon cancer typically is a very slow-growing cancer. You have years to detect it and years to get rid of it. But once it gets to the cancerous stage, it's very deadly, right? So anybody in your family is old enough to get a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, then, of course, you just got to help them be compliant, right, in that process, and it's not necessarily a pleasant process. All right, if you get scheduled for a sigmoidoscopy, sometimes they might say, oh, well, I see some funny things, but I only have a scope that can go 18 inches into your large intestine. And I really want to look at this ascending colon, which means I got to call you back next week. So when somebody says you need a sigmoidoscopy, in my opinion, what should you just ask for right away? Get the colonoscopy, get the whole thing done all at the same time. All right, so your insurance company might have a different view of that, but I think you should step up and say, oh, don't screw around with a sigmoidoscopy, just do a colonoscopy, and think of a good reason, like, oh, my dad had colon cancer, or my mom had colon cancer, right? And then you'll get scheduled for that. Because they do use anesthesia, not all the time, but usually they use anesthesia. That means that you can't drive yourself home when you have this exam. So you got to go with a family member or somebody that can drive you home. And that's an added expense, and so some insurance plans don't like to pay that added expense, but that's another thing that you should just ask for, is make sure that you have anesthesia, because you don't really want to be watching the video of that. Okay, another reason is that when you irritate a smooth muscle, right, like the muscularis externa right here, you start to poke at it and get it to move, smooth muscle has a tendency to contract when you stimulate it. So when you start manipulating the large intestine, all of that smooth muscle contracts. And have you ever had a Charlie horse, a skeletal muscle contraction, like in your arm, your leg? How does that feel when a muscle contracts all by itself and it doesn't relax? Oh, it hurts like hell, right? So guess what happens when all these smooth muscles here contract? That hurts like hell too. So that's a good reason to have anesthesia. There's no reason why you need to experience that. All right, so if you end up and you have for credit once you get into a clinical practice to get continuing medical education units, guess who you never want to miss? A gastroenterologist, because they'll even talk in a lot more detail, much better detail than I can, about all of this stuff. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around. I think I talked about everything pretty much except for the pancreas, but I think you can look at the pancreas yourself. All right, there's one parallel I want you to draw with the pancreas, and that has to do with the nervous system. All right, the autonomic nervous system has how many divisions to it? It's got two. What are the names of the two divisions? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic? They're antagonistic. So one division is excitatory while the other will be inhibitory on an organ. All right, the same kind of control is exerted over your blood glucose levels. And those two hormones come from the pancreas. Where's the pancreas at? Here's pancreas. Okay, pancreas, the endocrine division of the pancreas secretes two hormones. One is called insulin. We're probably familiar with that. Insulin decreases blood glucose levels when it's high. I think probably people have an intuitive sense of that. So when somebody's a diabetic, a kind of diabetic that's not secreting insulin, so after a meal, guess what they have to inject into themselves to decrease their blood glucose levels? That would be insulin. That's the passport that allows glucose to enter their cells. But that regulation in a normal person would be incomplete without its antagonistic counterpart. And the antagonistic counterpart to insulin in the normal individual is glucagon. Glucagon from the pancreas increases blood glucose levels. So it's the mixture of those two hormones that regulates your blood glucose so that it's in a normal range to maintain a healthy, disease-free state in your body. So insulin decreases blood glucose. The antagonistic hormone would be glucagon, which increases blood glucose. And the way it does that, one of the ways that it does that, is that it acts on the liver. The liver stores glucose in the form of glycogen, which is an animal starch. Glucagon causes the breakdown of glycogen from the liver. It goes into the blood and raises your blood glucose levels. That's where glucagon comes from. The root of that word is glycogen from the liver, which is a storage form of glucose. All right, so these are antagonistic to each other. Insulin and glucagon, that shouldn't remind you of a feudal system, but as a nice balanced system that maintains control over your blood glucose in a normal individual. All right, that's it for lecture for today. Question. Don't forget, I won't be here on Monday. I hope I don't forget. I'll be in trouble if I show up. Starch digestion. Amylase for starches or complex sugars. Lipase for complex lipids. Proteases for proteins. And a example of a complex sugar would be starch or glycogen. And we would have starch in our diet if we eat plants, and we'll have glycogen in our diet if we eat animal products. Our muscles store glycogen also. Or some types of our muscles do. Okay, I'm going to turn my recorder off. Oh, here's a good question. Supposedly, it enhances the good kind, and when you enhance the good kind, it inhibits the pathologic kind. Okay? And if somebody's on a course of antibiotics, or maybe they have an illness or something, sometimes you get antibiotics inappropriately for like treating a cold or flu, that kills the bacteria in your intestines, and some people then like to eat probiotics to reestablish those bacterial colonies in your digestive tract, which are necessary. Okay, because those beneficial bacteria prevent the overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria, and then they're also important for vitamin production. Okay.